You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
And welcome back to the Masters of Modern Podcast. I'm Ben Bateman in the Ben Bateman seat. There's no Alex Kessler here, but today we have Mr. Michael Grothy, the third piece of the trifecta.
Hi, everyone.
It's a very exciting week. Obviously, we have a brand new set coming out. Theros Beyond Death is just around the corner. We had our preview card last week. It was this guy here.
Modern Staple.
Field of the Dead, Modern Staple. Field of the Dead. That's what Alex put on this.
Field of Ruin. You're going to get messed up by Alex. You have to watch out if you spend too much time with Alex.
Yeah, so that was exciting, and we're back here. We're going to be talking about a bunch of the cool Theros spoilers. This is going to be like almost like part one of our set review. We decided to start the set review mid-spoiler season this time so that we weren't doing the thing where we did like 3 weeks of set reviews after people were no longer talking about the new set.
Right. I mean, everybody's excited about these cards now. You can see them. Why not start talking about them, giving our first impressions of the set and what these cards mean for, you know, Modern, Pioneer, whatever.
Yeah. So we've got Ruben Bressler here producing the show. What's up, Ruben? How you doing?
Better now, I think, that we're in the show.
Yeah.
A little, as producer, this is not my best producer credit.
Yeah. Hey, it happens. It happens. But here we are. We're talking Magic cards, Magic the Gathering. If you guys want to follow along with what the show's doing, please be sure to subscribe on YouTube, to hit that subscribe notification bell as we grow the channel. We have exciting stuff coming for you this year. A lot of big developments happening in the MMCast world, so be sure to do that. You can follow with me personally at Ben Bateman Media, at Kess Wiley, and at
Dudard, D-U-D-A-R-D-D.
Perfect. We have a Facebook group you guys can go be a part of. And please, please, please check out patreon.com/themmcast. It's the best way to support what we're doing and to continue to grow the show. We really do need your guys' support. So thank you so much for those of you that do support. And let's start talking Magic the Gathering. We've got a whole new set coming. I think we should just jump straight in maybe with right off the bat. Let's talk about the mechanics in Theros Beyond Death, because it feels like, you know, we brought back some, and then there's one in particular new mechanic that people are kind of freaking out about.
Yeah.
So we have Devotion coming back. How did you feel about Devotion the first time?
I like Devotion. I mean, I think it was a good bring back, better than Bestow or Heroic or Monstrous, for sure. I'd have to be my favorite from the original Theros. Yeah, I mean, it like rewards you for being really deep on a color that like kind of encourages monocolor strategies, which is, I think, interesting, right? Because it's easy to just like play all the color pairs or triples or whatever, and like, the fact that monocolor decks become more viable in an environment where Devotion is pushed means that you have, like, you know, five more decks you can play, right? Or color combos, at least.
Yeah, yeah. Devotion, for those on audio that maybe don't know, if you're listening to the show for the first time, it's a representation of the number of colored mana symbols of one color that you control as permanent. So if you have a creature that costs white, and thus it's your only permanent on the battlefield that has a color symbol on it, then your devotion to white is 2, your devotion to all other colors is 0.
And it counts colored artifacts and enchantments and planeswalkers and whatever. So if you've got a mono white deck with a bunch of white permanents, you'll have a big devotion to white. And if the cards can reward you for that, that is a good reason to be playing a monocolor deck that you might not have played earlier.
So secondly, we have coming back, we have Constellation. Constellation is basically the Enchantress mechanic. So it's whenever an enchantment enters the battlefield, something happens. It's usually referenced on the card itself, which is an enchantment, and then whenever an additional enchantment enters the battlefield, something happens. So like in the older set, it was like you gain a life, they lose a life. Some of these newer Constellation cards we'll be talking about, but it's just a very simple kind of enter the battlefield trigger for enchantments that is great. And if you're somebody who likes to play enchantments, you know, because obviously you're sacrificing the reactive sort of capability of an instant speed spell to play a kind of a clunkier permanent, it's hard to interact with. But if you're somebody who likes enchantments, then Constellation's right up your alley.
Yep.
I was always a big fan, so it's cool that it's back. We have something called Escape, which I think is the big one. Escape feels like it's the mechanic that most people are the most excited about.
Yeah.
As graveyard mechanics often are.
Yep, it's a graveyard mechanic, which is always somewhat dangerous. What's interesting about this one is that more than like flashback or it's more like retrace, because you can keep casting the escape card. So escape has a cost, like a mana cost. Typically, I think everything we've seen so far has a mana cost. And then you exile some number of cards from your graveyard. So it'll be, you know, escape 2 red, exile 3 other cards from your graveyard to cast this card from your graveyard. But it doesn't exile itself at the end of turn, like Unearth, if it's a creature. It doesn't exile itself immediately, like flashback, if it's a spell. So if you have enough cards in your graveyard, you can just keep casting these cards over and over. You can just have like a recursive threat that comes, a single card that comes back multiple times. You can have a single spell, like utility spell, that you just cast 2-3 times in a turn. So escape seems like it has the potential to be
pretty broken,
pretty strong.
Yeah, when I thought about escape, I started comparing it in my mind to, okay, so, you know, first of all, what are the limitations, right, based on the number? So if you have something that has escape 4 or escape 5, and you're a 60-card deck, you're going to start the game with 53 cards left in your library from the turn your first turn of the game starts. How many times are you going to be able to exile 4 cards, 5 cards at a time from your graveyard to be able to recast and redo something over and over again? Several. Definitely at least a few. I mean, it compares to, say, Delve, right?
Yeah, but I think it's like a combination of Retrace and Delve, kind of.
But Delve, you're getting to save so much mana, it's not about how many times you can do it. It's playing a Gurmag Angler one time is often enough to win the game, right?
Like, well, that's why I think it depends on the escape card. You know, I think some of these, like, 4 mana to cast, 6 mana to escape cards are not as exciting for Modern as much as something that's, say, you know, 3 mana to cast, 4 mana to escape, like the Titans or yeah, something like that, right? Or even Elspeth, where, like, she's just a fine 4 mana card, and then you can get her back for 6 late in the game when you have, like, extra mana and you're not doing anything. Like, how many times do you really need to cast a Planeswalker before you lose the game or you win the game, right?
It definitely feels like when you're talking about a card with a high power level, a permanent with a high power level, like a Planeswalker, that strikes me as the place where you would want to, you would get the most value out of a card with escape. You know, like a really high power flashback spell, basically, but it stays on the battlefield. So I think escape is pretty powerful. There's definitely some really great escape cards for us to talk about. But
yeah, and Modern in particular, I mean, you know, we're trying to branch out a little bit, talk about Pioneer as well, because we know there's a lot of people excited about Pioneer, and we are too, because it really is currently kind of a brewer's paradise. But I think escape is really going to shine more in Modern, where you have access to the dredge mechanic, you have access to fetch lands. It's much easier to stock your graveyard, which isn't to say that I don't think any of these cards will be playable in Pioneer, and we'll talk about that. But when I see an escape card, my first thought is, you know, if I fetch on turn 1 and I play a Mishra's Bauble and I, you know, play a Thought Scour on myself, and you can't do any of that in Pioneer. So
right. And I think that is the major difference between, say, Delve and Escape, is that Escape is not built to be that kind of a thing. Escape feels so much more like Eternalize or...
I mean, you can do that, though. Like, it's not too, like, out of the realm to expect to escape a 3-drop on turn 3, even if it takes 4 cards out of your graveyard in Modern. I mean, like, by the time you have 3 mana, you could have a bajillion cards in your graveyard.
Right.
I mean, just look at a deck like the Gurmag Angler decks, like Hollow One or Death Shadow or whatever. How many cards do they have in their graveyard on turn 3?
Well, I think let's start talking about some of the cards, because we will actually talk about some of the actual cards in question here. Why don't we start with...
We've got a big list of cards here that we thought were interesting, so we got to sort through a little bit.
Maybe we start with Ashiok Nightmare Ruse. You want to just start with the Planeswalkers right off the bat?
Yeah, I mean, I think whenever a set comes out, it's always important to talk about the Planeswalkers, especially given the power of the 2019 Planeswalkers. We'll see if the 2020 Planeswalkers can keep up. So Ashiok Nightmare Muse is a 5-drop Planeswalker with 5 loyalty, plus 1, create a 2/3 blue and black Nightmare creature token with whenever this creature attacks or blocks. Each opponent exiles the top 2 cards of their library. -3, return target non-land permanent to its owner's hand. Then that player exiles a card from their hand. And then -7, so 2 pluses to ultimate. You may cast up to 3 face-up cards your opponent own from exile without paying their mana costs.
So it combines some of the aspects of old original OG 3 mana Ashiok. It has some of the flavor of the exiling cards and getting things out of it. Its defensive capability is basically recoil.
So yeah.
It's a 5 mana planeswalker that comes down on 5 loyalty that goes down to 2 to not quite recoil, but a little better than recoil in a lot of cases, because yeah. exiling the card instead of discarding it.
It's pretty much always better than recoil.
Yeah, you can interact with the card later.
Right, yeah. It reminds me of some of the Eldrazi from Battle for Zendikar, where they were doing like the processor thing, where you like exile a bunch of cards, and then you like play your processor to like use the cards you've exiled. This Ashiok kind of does that. And what's interesting is it's any exiled card your opponents own for any reason, whereas the previous Ashiok could only put creatures in that were exiled by Ashiok.
Yeah, right. Like whether they're exiling their own things to delve or whatnot, you still have access to it. So right. that's definitely an interesting aspect. I mean, it's a 5-mana planeswalker. Five-mana planeswalkers really require a lot to make an impact in anything modern or more powerful. You literally have to be dealing with like 5-mana Tezzeret, Teferi. Those are like
And 5-mana Tezzeret and Teferi, both like ones who have seen play in modern historically, like untap mana.
Yeah.
So you're not really paying 5 for them. I mean, you're paying 5, but you're immediately getting a rebate so you can interact. Because just like tapping 5 mana to tap out for something in modern is generally very risky, especially if you're a blue deck like what this Ashiok is doing.
Yeah, I would say this card is on the lower power level for me, so I think we can move on probably to...
Might be interesting in standard, or... I don't know that it's got legs in eternal formats.
Yeah, let's talk Elspeth, Sun's Nemesis. This card's a lot more powerful, in my opinion.
Yeah, I agree.
White 2, Legendary Planeswalker Elspeth comes down on 5 loyalty, minus 1. Up to 2 target creatures you control each get +2/+1 until end of turn. -2, create 2/1/1 white human creature tokens. -3, you gain 5 life and escape. White 4, exile 4 cards, 4 other cards from your graveyard. So it's got escape 4, but it costs 6 to cast it. I think this card's fantastic. This card, to me, strikes me as a perfect control type of finisher. This, like, it makes threats, it makes those threats bigger to win the game, keeps you alive if you need it to, and if you just burn it as like a fog where you just play it, make the 1/1s, they find a way to kill it, later in the game you're able to recast it.
Yeah, it's also interesting because it's like a planeswalker that you can, you know, have milled off of a Thought Scour or something and cast it later. You like, that's a form of card advantage, right? If this somehow got in your graveyard, I'm not thinking of how a white deck would put this in their graveyard, but you know, if you did put it in your graveyard somehow, you discarded it to something, or it got thought seized, even, you could just get it back in the late game and you're like kind of drawing a card, right?
Yeah, I think definitely in a white blue control deck, which I think is probably where a lot of people would consider this card to be, I think this card's pretty powerful. So let me ask you, like, old Elspeth, 4-mana Elspeth, not Sun's Champion, but Knight Errant, the original 4-mana, which for a long time was considered in the top 3 planeswalkers of all time. How do you think this card compares to that Elspeth in a basic blue-white control shell?
So they both win the game pretty slowly, I think is the reason why that Elspeth has kind of fallen out of favor in Modern. It used to get played in kind of the like Naya Zoo decks with Wild and the Cattle and stuff and Curd Ape. But, you know, neither of them are like rushing towards an end game. The one thing I will say about Knight Errant is that, like, at least Knight Errant kind of is a continuous value engine that never goes away, whereas this planeswalker only minuses, so eventually you're going to have to escape her to get her back and pay a bunch of mana. But -2 to make 2 1/1s is pretty good.
Yeah.
And the fact that it gains life means that, like, it can shore up matchups against, like, Burn or against Flyers or something that, like, the old Elspeth was pretty weak against. It also, like, if it gets countered or if you play it and it just immediately eats, like, a Dreadbore or Hero's Downfall or something, like, you can escape it back. I mean, yeah, I don't know. I think that escape is very powerful on this Planeswalker, and I think that the existence of escape makes it easy to underestimate this because, like, your opponent can never truly get rid of it. It's just a question of, like, if it's fast enough.
Well, I think one of the really interesting things about this card that's different than most planeswalkers we've seen is that it has 3 abilities. They're all minuses, and the way those 3 abilities add up together all can basically add up to or equal to 5 loyalty exactly. So, like, yeah. Right, so, like, it doesn't have any way to plus itself. Yep. So it feels a little bit more like the War of the Spark Planeswalkers in the sense that you just get a limited number of uses and then it's gone.
Yeah, the uncommon ones.
Yeah, right. But all of those ones obviously had an ability. Once you had used up the loyalty, they stayed on the battlefield and did something for you. This doesn't have that, but it does allow you to get it back later. So I think it's a really interesting card. I like this card. It actually feels like it has the utility to provide some reach for kind of aggressive decks in the same way you were talking about with the old Elspeth.
Yeah, I mean, a 4-mana Planeswalker that immediately makes two bodies and can make two bodies twice is like, I mean, that's a lot of bodies.
Yeah.
If you, you know, have some incentive to go wide, or if you need chump blockers, you can like chump with one to protect Elspeth and then use the other one to attack the next turn with the, you know, +2/+1 or whatever. So, I mean, -2 to make two humans, I think, is pretty strong. I think this is like a little bit of a long shot for modern. And I don't think that there's like a good shell for it in Pioneer, although I guess it'd just be blue white, same. But yeah, we'll see. I mean, Pioneer is also missing some of the powerhouse planeswalkers like Jace the Mind Sculptor that are competing for slots with this, and Knight Errant is not in as well. Yeah. So I don't know. Maybe Gideon, Ally of Zendikar, is maybe what this is realistically competing with.
That's fair.
And the two bodies versus one and the escape, maybe it gets there a little bit. Gideon kills faster because he turns into a creature, but you're trading like staying power for speed, basically.
Let's talk the third Planeswalker. Not that I think this one is particularly good, but it's kind of like it's an enchantment Planeswalker, yep. So to speak.
Yep.
It's weird that I thought they could have just made this Planeswalker legendary enchantment Planeswalker, and they didn't.
That would have been cool.
Right? I guess it's space they didn't want to play
like
in yet.
Karn's not an artifact.
Yeah, but it's like this, especially with the ability we're about to talk about, this feels like it could have... They could have just leaned into it, but Kallax, Destiny's Hand, costs white, green, 2, legendary Planeswalker, Kallax. It's the first Kallax we've seen, right? New character?
Yep, new character from Theros.
4 loyalty, +1, look at the top 4 cards of your library. You may reveal an enchantment from among them and put it into your hand. God, the text is small. Put the rest on the bottom of your library in random order. Can I like zoom in on this? There we go. -3, I'm old. -3, exile target creature or enchantment you don't control until target enchantment you do control leaves the battlefield. They could have made Kallax an enchantment. She could have targeted
it's a guy.
Okay, Kallax, a guy. He could have targeted himself as the thing that he had to leave on the battlefield to stay around, and then he would have been basically just like a 4-mana Oblivion Ring. I'd be totally into that. Why didn't they do that? That makes total sense.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, he does. It's a 4-mana Planeswalker, plus his draw a card, minus to kill a creature, has an ultimate that doesn't do much, actually. So
-7, return all enchantment cards from your graveyard to the battlefield. It has a Starfield of Nyx effect, sort of.
Yeah, replenish. I mean, like, that's pretty rarely going to do a lot. And in order to plus and truly draw a card, you got to be playing a ton of enchantments. I think that even if this set, you know, kind of creates an enchantress style deck in any format, standard, modern, pioneer, legacy, whatever, it's I don't think that card quite has a home. Maybe in standard, but
they can't all be
winners.
I think
the power level is low.
Yeah, they can't all be winners, so I think
it does help you find specific enchantments because it digs 4 deep, and like the fact that it can come down and kill something immediately if you have an enchantment out means that, like, I guess maybe in standard, but I don't think anywhere else.
I think that's like a standard brew card. I think it's a fringe card somebody will have a lot of fun playing. Let's talk about one of the most splashy cards printed so far. This is a Pioneer big deal of a card, and that is Heliod, Sun's Crown. White, 2 for a 5/5 legendary enchantment creature god. Indestructible. As long as your devotion to white is less than 5, Heliod isn't a creature. Whenever you gain life, put a +1/+1 counter on target creature or enchantment you control. Has an activated ability of white and 1, another target creature you control. Sorry, another target creature gains lifelink until end of turn. So the combo with this card is with Walking Ballista, right?
Yep.
It's a 2-card combo. You give Walking Ballista lifelink. Walking Ballista, as long as it has 1 additional counter on it to survive the hit.
If you just ping them, you gain 1 life because your ballista has lifelink. You put another counter because you gained life.
Got it. Okay.
And you use the counter that Heliod puts to ping again. You get another counter, you ping again.
So ballista has to have 2 counters on it to be able to do it because it has to survive the ping, but otherwise it just wins the game. You can give it lifelink.
Yep.
2-card combo. So Pioneer now has a 2-card combo. People have talked about this as Pioneer Splinter Twin. I've seen this, people talking about it. It's not really like...
So the earliest I've seen speculated is turn 3. You play a mana dork on turn 1. You play Heliod on turn 3. And Heliod is relatively safe at that point because it's a indestructible enchantment. It's not a creature.
Right.
And then you play the Ballista for 2 mana, leaving 1 mana untapped. You play Radiant Fountain on turn 3.
Okay.
and then Radiant Fountain triggers Heliod to put the second counter on the Ballista, and then you use the Radiant Fountain and your other untapped mana, be it the Dork or whatever, to give the Ballista lifelink.
Life
and it's now got two counters and lifelink, and you do the thing.
So you need, yeah, you need an exact sequence of cards and lands to be able to pull it off. It's not going to be likely or
turn
common.
Turn three, right. But
and I mean, a mana dork.
Turn four is perhaps more likely, but... I mean, you can also get Heliod off of Collected Company. You can't get Ballista off of Collected Company, but there's like talk of that type of thing. You can, in Modern, you can use Eladomri's Call to find Ballista, or you can use even Trinket Mage or something like that.
I guess in Modern, you could get, if you're looking for possibly Radiant Fountain or Ballista, Ancient Stirrings maybe gets played in this deck.
Maybe.
You know, Stirrings on turn one to dig for your Ballista.
Maybe
or dig for
Incubation
the
Incongruity.
Oh, you know, I love that card. You always do like to bring that card up around me and smile, because that's like, I think you actually think the card's bad.
No, I'm playing it in Standard right now, actually. I'm playing it in Teamer Adventures in Standard.
I have such a soft spot for that card.
Yeah. No, I know. But I mean, and you know, it does what you're looking for, right? Because you want to put Ballista in your hand. Like, the big card filtering or tutoring stuff that we usually see in Modern for creatures is Collected Company or like Court of Calling or Finale of Devastation, but those all put the creature on the battlefield, so it's no good for Ballista. I mean, I guess you could like tutor for Ballista, put it in the graveyard with Finale, and then like Company into Heliod and Eternal Witness and get it. But I mean, it's probably better to just put the Ballista directly in your hand. And, you know, Once Upon a Time We'll Do It, which is still legal in Modern for now. We'll see if it gets the axe like it did in Pioneer. But yeah, I mean, in Pioneer, Collected Company is also legal. And the thing about Heliod is like, you can build your deck in a way where Heliod just does something already. So you can either be like a Soul Sisters heavy deck where you're like really taking advantage of that ability, or you can just kind of be like a green white, value Collected Company deck that's playing like a Heliod to tutor for. Walking Bliss is just a good card. You could play four of those if you want. You could even play more Heliods. And then you just are playing Scavenging Ooze, Courser of Crucifix. You can play, in Modern, you can play Spike Feeder, which also goes infinite with Heliod because you remove the counter to get gain two life, put a counter back, remove the counter, gain two life.
Yeah, Heliod is just generally good. You're right. With Ooze especially, that seems hot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, so the thing about this combo versus Splinter Twin is that like Deceiver Exarch and Pestermite are both pretty low impact on their own. They do something. Splinter Twin and Kiki Jiki are just like, they do nearly nothing on their own. I mean, I guess there's historically been times when people have like put it on a Snapcaster and Wall of Omens or something, but like they're much more niche cards than Heliod, I feel. And you can just play out Heliod and kind of expect it to live for a while too.
Yeah.
Because it's an indestructible enchantment that is often not a creature. Now, if you're playing it in more of a Soul Sisters type build, it'll be a creature more often because you have all these like little dorky one pip creatures.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, I think that like there's, because it's two cards, a white card and a colorless card, there's like a lot of shells that you can just slot this two card combo in, which is what the problem with Splinter Twin was, right? Is that people were just slotting Splinter Twin into the Grixis decks or into a Jeskai control deck or into a, you know, a teamer deck with Tarmogoyf that was like a tempo. Like you could just slot it into any deck because the combo package was so small. And it's the same with this. It's just eight cards, maybe less if you have ways of search.
And the list is really good.
And Ballista is just a good card.
Ballista is like already one of the most played creatures in Pioneer. So
yeah.
I mean, this is Modern level powerful. This is a real thing you can be doing in Modern. So,
and even if you have like a Hardened Scales deck, like Mono Green Hardened Scales, which is a big player in Pioneer, you can just like splash Heliod.
Yeah.
If you wanted. I mean, I don't know if you have a ton of ways to gain life, but maybe there's a way to build that deck where that's legitimate, right? I mean.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit more about the rest of these gods. I think, you know, Heliod is the big one, but I think, you know, Thassa, I've seen people get excited about. Thassa, one blue, three colorless for 6/5 indestructible legendary enchantment creature god. As long as your devotion to blue is less than 5, Thassa isn't a creature. At the beginning of your end step, exile up to one other target creature you control, then return that card to the battlefield under your control. One blue, three colorless, tap another target creature. So, this type of effect, the sort of repeatable blink effect, very, very popular casual type of effect. One of the most popular, right? ETB is like, that goes down in history as like a blue-white blink deck is like one of the classic things people just like to build when they get into Magic.
Yeah, this has a similar ability to Conjurer's Closet, which gets played a lot in Commander.
But Conjurer's Closet costs 5, and it's easy to interact with. This is hard to interact with, and it costs 4, so it's definitely better in that sense. I think this card's fine. This won't be a player in Modern, I don't think. It's a good thing that it has the blink ability is end of turn instead of upkeep, because it means you're going to get something the turn that you play it. It's a clever card. I just think it's a little expensive to be able to do the type of things in Modern people want to be doing right now. What do you think?
Yeah, I think if it costs 3, maybe. I mean, the other Thassa kind of got played. The other Thassa was like more of an aggressive card, whereas this is more of a value engine. But like, it depends on what your deck's looking for, right? Sometimes you want an aggressive card. Sometimes you want a value engine. And at 3 mana, it's cheap enough that you can, you know, play it, not just like have your 4 mana enchantment that is conditional.
Do you think that the fact that the tap ability is so expensive will inhibit what this card actually gets to do? 4 is a lot.
Yeah, I just think that that's like a small bonus that's tacked on. I don't think that that's the reason you play the card. In the same way that the previous Thassa, the reason you played the card was because it was a 5/5 that you could turn into a creature reliably and it can make itself or something else unblockable. And the scry was kind of a bonus. This tap is just kind of a bonus.
Okay.
I mean, you'll use it sometimes to like tap down their only blocker, or tap down their only attacker or whatever. But
moving on to Erebos, Bleak Hearted. Black 3 for a 5/6 Indestructible God. Same ability. If a devotion is less than 5, it isn't a creature. Whenever another creature you control dies, you may pay 2 if you do draw a card. Pay 2 life, sorry. That's a significant ability. And Black 1, sacrifice another creature. Target creature gets -2/-1 till end of turn. So you're able to, for 2 mana, you know, take out like a mana dork or some sort of a pinger, pay 2 life to draw a card when you do it. It sort of uses your 2 mana and 2 life to get an ability and draw a card. I mean, that's a good repeatable effect. 4 is expensive to be able to do this, but I mean, you also have to sacrifice another creature to do it. So
yeah, I mean, one thing that's nice. So, I mean, you can play this like a Carrion Feeder on board and immediately sacrifice some stuff and get some value. And this is a little bit different from other effects like this, which have been mandatory in the past, like Midnight Reaper or Grim Harvest Specs is non-token creature, but it doesn't damage you. And then there's another one, Dark Prophecy or something. It's like black, black, black.
Sure.
It's an enchantment, and it also deals you 1 damage and you draw a card, like mandatory. So what's nice about this is like if you take a bunch of damage and your life gets low, you may pay 2 lives. You just don't have to.
Yeah,
which is nice. I mean, I've killed people with their Midnight Reaper on Magic Arena and Standard. So like if you're playing a deck where you would be considering Midnight Reaper, I think it's better. I don't know. I was going to say maybe you want to play Erebos, but I don't think that's true even in Standard.
Yeah, I think there's some value to this card. I mean, I think the fact that a couple things. So it's indestructible, which means that if you have this on board and you're in some sort of control deck that has an ability to not lose all of its life and to stay alive and you Wrath, you can lose your couple creatures maybe early that you've put on board to gain value, pay 4, draw 2, keep your permanent on board for like the next time it goes around.
Yeah.
It's definitely not the worst. I don't think this card is like a Modern level planeswalker sort of effect, but I definitely think the fact that it's indestructible and it has this ability to refill your hand when you Wrath is pretty good. You know, I think I could see this in control decks as like a one of, but probably there's not a Modern.
Well, control decks, you're not going to have a lot of creatures you control dying. I mean, the place in Standard that people are thinking about it is like in a mono blue black devotion deck where you're likely to turn it on, and you are playing Cauldron Cat, the Cauldron,
yeah,
or the Witch's Oven Cat combo. I always want to call it a cauldron, but it's not. It's
no,
oven.
That's a good point. I think, yeah, you're probably right that there's not a deck that's going to be doing that. But I don't know. Like, there have been control decks in the past that have played like Wall of Omens type of effect.
And I think it's only a matter of time until we see the Cat Oven combo breaking out into Modern. I just don't know that this 4 mana enchantment is a part of that deck. But I mean, if it's a Oven Cat deck that can reliably hit Devotion to Black and get the 5/6, maybe Erebos shows up.
Yeah. All right, let's talk about the other two gods. We've got Purphoros. Purphoros, 1 red, 4 colorless, 7/6 enchantment creature god, legendary, indestructible, as long as your devotion is less than 5, it isn't a creature. Other creatures you control have haste, so it's got Urbresque. It's got the Urbresque effect. And then for red and 2, you may put a red creature card or an artifact creature card from your hand onto the battlefield, sacrifice it at the beginning of the next end step. So it has both the Urbresque effect and it has a Through the Breach style effect attached to it.
Yep.
This card's interesting. I think this card's totally interesting. Like, I think for 3 mana to be able to sneak attack something, that's pretty powerful.
Totally. And I mean, 5 mana is steep to get him, excuse me, into play. But yeah, sneak attack is a card that's worth paying some mana for.
Yeah. Other creatures you control have haste. I mean, so yeah, this card's good. It's 5. It's probably a little expensive to do anything in modern. I still think you would probably
It's 5 and then 3. So because it is indestructible, it's like relatively resilient to removal. So if you have time to just tap out next turn, you can play a land and get 6 mana and sneak in 2 things, and that will hopefully win you the game.
Yeah, it doesn't really have much to do with Old Purphoros, right? The ability is nothing. Purphoros, like, basically, didn't Old Purphoros +2/+0 and 2 damage to each opponent whenever a creature enters the battlefield? Or is that... Yeah, I think this card's cool. I don't see this being a modern player. What's the best red? What's the best red, destroyer in Pioneer?
Ilharg is a big one.
Ilharg.
It's the boar god. You could do some red pantheon stuff going on. It's the boar god from War of the Spark. When it attacks, you can put any creature from your hand into play.
Okay.
So that allows you to put in the heavy hitters, the Grizzlebrands, the Emrakuls, the whatever you want to put in. Now, in Pioneer, I suppose you don't have access to Grizzlebrand, but you can put World's Bend Worm or something like that. But yes, if there is a good way, Drakuseth from M20 is one that people are talking about in Standard as well as Pioneer. It's a 7/7 dragon. Whenever it attacks, you choose, I don't know how it's worded, but you choose 3 targets. You deal 3 to 2 of them and 4 to 1 of them. So you can wipe your opponent's board. You can deal 4 to them and kill off a creature. You can
Dragonlord Atarka. But does Dragonlord Atarka trigger on cast or enter?
Enter.
Oh, okay. So Dragonlord Atarka is a
I've natural
good.
Ordered for Dragonlord Atarka in cube before.
Yeah, so that seems like a pretty good
in
one.
In the last week.
That strikes me as... And Dragonlord Atarka is an 8/8, is that right?
Yeah, 8/8 trample flying.
So that seems pretty bonkers. I think you
can... And artifact creatures, so you can do Blightsteel, the classic. That's, you know, your opponent has to have no blockers, and that's a modern card, but
yeah,
it's a thing.
Yeah, it costs 5.
Mere cool. Battle Sphere.
Big fan of that one.
Yeah. I'm a big fan of that one.
Triskelevus. All right,
so what's also interesting is you sacrifice the beginning of the next end step, so you can raise dead the creature or reanimate it or whatever. I mean, it has a little more play to it than like Exile, which is what you see on these types of effects nowadays.
Let's talk Green God Nylea, Keen-Eyed. The art on this is remarkably similar to the old Nylea. Is that true?
Yeah, she's jumping now.
Yeah. You got Green 3, same ability, less than 5, isn't a creature. It's a 5/6 indestructible. Creature spells you cast cost 1 less to cast. Green 2, reveal the top card of your library. If it's a creature card, put it into your hand. Otherwise, you may put it into your graveyard. I think this card is pretty bad. I think this card is... If it costs 3 mana or 2 mana... I could see it being pushed and really cool. It costing 4 to reduce spells by 1 on the next one, and then like 3 to maybe hit a creature just seems like pretty loose, right?
I think it's like a standard sideboard card. Maybe like a Pioneer mono green devotion sideboard card, because it's like a card advantage engine. If your opponent is looking to 1-for-1 you out of the game, if they're like a blue white control or a blue black control or something, and they're like removal spell, planeswalker, like, and you start falling behind on cards, this is going to get you back in, right? And it'll sometimes attack as a 5/6 if you're like a big green deck, because if you're theoretically a big green deck, you can spend the mana on the card draw because you have the mana. It's like a sideboard card, and I don't think it's ever going to make it to modern. But I can see it as I think it'll be a standard sideboard player in grindy matchups, and I think it'll be maybe a Pioneer standard player, particularly since there's a strong mono green devotion deck already.
Okay, that's fair. Let's talk the Dryad.
That's the one you want to talk about?
Yeah.
It's a Dryad of the Elysian Grove.
It is green and 2 for a 2/4 enchantment creature, Nymph. You may play an additional land each turn. Lands you control are all basic land types in addition to their other types. So it's a 2/4 creature for 3 that has an exploration attached to it and also is a Prismatic Vista? Omen. Prismatic Omen, that's the one. Vista is the land. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this is interesting, right? I mean, the fact that it's a 2/4 means it blocks, that it's... wrath proof of something like Anger of the Gods in your classic sort of 3 damage sweepers, and it's going to ramp you into more lands to hit your scapeshift, and then also makes it so your scapeshift is even better. It seems pretty good to me.
Definitely worth considering an escape shift deck, and like, you know, there's a lot of talk nowadays that like is Primeval Titan the best creature in Modern right now? And this is a card that really wants to play with Primeval Titan because it works really well with Valakut. It plays additional lands in like an amulet type deck that are playing like Azusa. Now, Azusa is a little more explosive than this because two extra lands per turn. This really wants to be in more of a scape shift shell, but it can be like the Azusa of the Valakut deck, right?
Yeah, but here's the thing. So Azusa allows you to play two additional lands. So like turn three or whatever, you play an Azusa. Let's just say you happen to have two more lands in your hand. You play them both. But the next turn, you're not going to have three lands to play the next turn unless you draw a lot of cards.
Well, like the Amulet Titan decks are using the bounce lands with Amulet.
To do it again, for sure. But I'm just thinking, like, if I'm thinking about ramping into a Primeval Titan and I'm not doing something crazy like the Amulet deck, but in scape shift, presumably you play this on turn three, you play a fourth land. Turn four, you can just play Primeval Titan. You just go land, Titan. That's the thing you could do. That seems powerful. This seems pushed enough.
Yeah, I mean, if you go like just turn three this, you can play turn four Titan, assuming you have all the lands.
Yeah. I mean, you have to have six lands.
Over four turns. I mean, at that point, you've got 11 cards. Six of them are lands.
It's more likely
one of them's this, one of them's Titan.
Yeah.
But that's assuming you do nothing, right? I mean, I think the fact that this survives Anger of the Gods was a good point by you, because in a Valakut deck, you are probably playing red. I mean, this allows you to kill faster, right? So I played Scapeshift for a long time. You kill on seven lands because you need, for each mountain you control, you need four other mountains. So you need seven lands because that's two Valakuts and five mountains. No, wait. Did I just get my math wrong?
No, you need seven lands for Scapeshift to be.
Five and then
21 damage. Yeah. No, it's
18. No. So it's one Valakut and six because it's for each mountain you need five other mountains. I got my Valakut math wrong.
Yeah,
so that's 18 damage. But with this, that's now 21 damage because the Valakut that you got is a mountain. And in fact, if you get two Valakuts, they are both mountains.
Yeah.
So now you could just do seven times.
Couldn't you get four Valakuts?
You do 21 times. Yeah, you get four Valakuts, depending on how many you're playing, right?
Yeah.
Like if you're playing straight green-red Titan, you're probably playing four Valakuts.
Four Valakuts?
Yeah, so you can just deal like an outrageous amount of damage. Whereas before, if you scape shift, you need seven mana and you need to get six mountains.
Yeah.
So you only deal 18. So this like makes your kill turn much quicker. And in fact, you can kill on with only six lands. All six of them are mountains.
Am I correct in thinking that if you hit seven lands, four which are Valakuts, you're doing 72 damage? Is that right?
Six lands with four Valakuts?
So it's 18 times four, right?
It's 18 times four, yeah.
Yeah, 72. Sick.
Yeah, so savage. You don't need to deal that much damage. But the main thing is that like Prismatic Omen speeds you up a full turn.
Yeah. I think the other thing, too,
because it allows you to kill on six lands instead of seven.
Talking about Titan on turn four, it's actually a turn three Titan in a lot of the cases because you're going to play Search for Tomorrow on turn one in that deck in a lot of cases. So that's,
of course.
So Search is going to hit this for you on turn three.
And Castle Garenbrig can hit your Titan earlier.
Yeah.
I mean, this just seems like a deck that slots so easily into Valakut Primeval Titan strategies that, like, it's definitely going to see some modern play. And, you know, maybe it's turns out that it's not the best Titan build and these like weird Simic Titan decks with Field of the Dead are better or Amulet Titan is better and this guy just isn't better than Azusa and Amulet Titan.
Yeah.
But I think that this guy puts Valakut back on the menu, you know, at least worth testing.
So other cards that I want to talk about. You want to talk about this?
What are you excited about? Ooh, yeah, let's do the Ox. I like the Ox. So is
the Ox
Ox
yoked?
Of Agonis. It's I would say that it's even more yoked than the Yoked Ox.
Nobody's more yoked than the Yoked Ox. Have you seen him?
So it's a, I guess it does have much less toughness, this Ox, but it's more powerful. So it is Ox of Agonis is the card. Three red to cast, 4/2. When it enters the battlefield, discard your hand, then draw three cards. And it has escape, red, exile eight other cards from your graveyard. And it escapes with a +1 counter. So if you escape it, it's a 5/3 instead of a 4/2. I mean, this card just kind of screams dredge. You cast it from your graveyard for the low price of two mana. You have to exile eight other cards, which is no problem. That's two dredges are probably putting at least eight cards worth of garbage in your deck or in your graveyard, not to mention fetches or whatever else. And then when it enters the battlefield, you discard your hand and dredge three times, which sounds great because you have all these stinkweed imps and crap in your hand that you didn't want anyway. You discard them and you dredge them.
And more oxes, probably.
And you get more oxes. I mean, it seems like it slots right into dredge because red is a mana cost that they can easily hit, pretty quickly, and it only takes like probably two dredges to get the eight other cards in your graveyard.
Yeah, I think this card feels like a real modern dredge card. I think this is definitely playable. I think this will be played. I'm thinking how fast that deck usually functions, and dredging this on turn two or on turn three doesn't even seem outrageous, actually.
Yeah, I mean, with no Faithless Looting, like, the dredge deck's a little slower. More of a turn three, but with, like, Cathartic Reunion and then, like, dredge. And
Now
you've got a big stocked graveyard with an ox in it. But yeah, I mean, this seems... It's not very often that they print a card that's like, oh, yeah, definitely goes in dredge. They try and stray away from cards that, like, obviously go in dredge because they tend to be busted. The exile eight other cards makes me think that this card is not as busted as you might think in when there is not the word dredge involved, because that's so many cards that it's like pretty hard to bring this back.
It's kind of like why Temporal Trespass was like impossible to make work, because what was it? Wasn't the hard cast on that like 13?
It's 11, I think. 11. Blue 8.
Yeah. So you have to
say that also requires eight other cards.
Eight cards, yeah.
But yeah, I mean, like, this casts from your graveyard, so you can play it in Pioneer, theoretically, if you had like a Jund kind of Satyr Wayfinder deck. You could get this in your graveyard, but the like speed at which you put cards in your graveyard is so much slower, and the enters the battlefield, discard your hand, draw three is fine. I mean, it's Bedlam Reveler's ability. People have played that before, but it's not nearly as impactful when you're not discarding your hand, put 15 cards into your graveyard from your library.
Yeah. Should we talk about the one crazy red card that everyone's been talking about? The Yogg-Will?
Sure. This card has so many possibilities. I don't know if I'm...
What's it called again?
Prepared.
Underworld Breach. It is one red, one colorless enchantment. Each non-land card in your graveyard has escape. The escape cost is equal to the card's mana cost plus exile three other cards from your graveyard at the beginning of the end step sacrifice Underworld Breach. So, we mentioned escape. We talked about how powerful it is. It seems like a lot of the cards we've talked about today have escape. It's one of the most exciting mechanics we've seen in a little while. How good is this? So, let's start at the top. In Standard, this probably will have a deck that is played with it because they wouldn't design it otherwise. I can't imagine they would put this into a Standard set if they didn't think it would at least be fun to have in Standard.
I don't think that's true. I mean, they print cards for Eternal formats. I mean, I think this card's most exciting applications are in Eternal formats because it resembles Yawgmoth's Will, right? It allows you to cast all the cards in your graveyard. You got to pay their mana cost, but you got to pay their mana cost with Yawgmoth's Will.
You can't play lands. You can't play lands out of your yard, though.
You cannot play lands. Each non-land card, yes. But you can, you know, recast your Lion's Eye Diamond or your Pyretic Ritual or your Manamorphose or whatever, right? Like, you can really do some nasty combo stuff with this. The trick is that you got to have a huge graveyard, which is one of the reasons I think Lion's Eye Diamond is cool with this, because you can replay Lion's Eye Diamond for as many things are in your graveyard, get a ton of mana, use the mana to do whatever you want, put more cards in your graveyard, you know, who knows what you're doing at that point. But that's what's interesting about this also is that unlike Yawgmoth's Will, like with Yawgmoth's Will, you play the Lion's Eye Diamond, you sacrifice it, you get the three mana, it's gone.
Yeah.
But with this, the Lion's Eye Diamond goes back in your graveyard, Underworld Breach re-gives it escape, so you can just keep doing that. So in some situations where you have infinite, in a situation where you have infinite cards in your graveyard, it's better than Yawgmoth's Will because the cards go back to your graveyard where you can recast them. You can just cast Manamorphose seven times with a Goblin Electromancer out. Granted, you got to have 21 cards in your graveyard to do that, but it's legal.
Yeah, I mean, so we talked about, you know, at the beginning of the show when we were actually mentioning the mechanic of escape. So if you're just trying to sort of crunch the numbers of like, all right, how ham can you go with an escape? If this card's going to give everything in your graveyard escape three, that's actually one of the lower escape costs.
Totally. Lower than most of the cards that it's printed on.
Yeah. So, you know, you start with 53 cards. By the time you probably get going, you're going to have something like, I don't know, 45 cards maybe left in your deck. So if you're milling yourself and you're filling your graveyard to be able to do something crazy, you can't like storm out in a grape shot type of way because you won't have enough cards. You would have to... the math would have to be quite precise to be able to like mill yourself and be able to like recast something for one damage that mills three every time over and over again. So like, for instance, the card Stitcher's Supplier goes extremely well with Underworld Breach. That's like one of the best possible things I can think of that you could be doing with this. If you have some way to sacrifice a creature to generate mana.
Yeah, that's true.
Is there a card that sacrifices a creature to add one mana of any color? There is, right?
Yeah. It's in Legacy, though. It's a Phyrexian Altar. So it's not legal in Modern or Pioneer.
It's for X. It's two mana. Two mana artifact or three
mana? Three mana artifact.
And you sacrifice a creature, add one mana, then it goes. It's from Invasion, right?
Yeah, it's from Invasion.
Yeah. So, okay, so you sacrifice him, you mill three, you put him back in play, you mill three. So that gives you infinite mana, right? Or gives you infinite escapes?
Well, as...
You can cast him infinite times.
Yes, you can. If you were... Well, you sac for a mana, but then you spend the mana. But like, more real... For like Modern or Pioneer... You can use like any sacrifice outlet that's free. So you can use like Woe Strider from this set, which is a free sacrifice outlet. Yeah, we haven't seen one in a while. Or Carrion Feeder if you're in Modern. And you can just sacrifice Citrus Supply or play it for one. So you're basically putting six cards in your graveyard for one each one mana you spend, which is a pretty good deal.
It's a good rate.
Well, I guess three, because you're exiling three. So you're putting six, exiling three each time.
That's kind of what I'm
stocking your graveyard.
You're kind of making my point. He's one of the most aggressive ways that combos with this card to mill yourself, because he's cheap and he gets you six for every exchange. You're only going to have like 45 cards in your deck. You're only going to be able to do it a few times before your deck's empty. Like, you're I think the coolest thing about this effect is that it's pretty costly. You can't just do something that wants to do something 20 times. You have to do something like 9 times or 8 times probably to win. You know, like,
yeah.
If you kind of add,
you can
it all
still
up.
Play cards from your hand while this is going on too,
yeah,
right?
It's fair.
So like, you're still able to like, you know, play a Thought Scour from your graveyard and mill two, and it like kind of replaced the three cards you escaped for. But now you've drawn a card. You play the card from your hand, and then see like. I don't know. It's hard for me to say what the best shell for this is, but it's like such a massive combo card. It allows you to like do storm stuff or mill your whole deck pretty easily type stuff.
But I think also it's the fact that it costs two and okay, end of turn, you just sacrifice it and then do it again later in the game. It's not like you have to, the turn you cast it, you have to go crazy because at end of turn you lose the game or something.
Yeah.
It's just you can do this and it can basically act as a two for one, draw you two cards or something.
And yeah, it's true. And you'll maybe while you're comboing, you draw another one and you're like, I'm just going to try again next turn.
So I think it's pretty powerful. I think it's one of the most exciting cards in the set. I think this will probably have implications all the way down to Vintage, I would think. Like,
I'm sure one of us will have some type of janky Underworld Breach brew at some point, but not during the First Impressions episode.
No. I want to talk quickly about Uro, Titan of Nature's Wrath. I think this card is super cool. It got spoiled this morning, I believe.
Yeah.
Blue-green, one legendary creature, Elder Giant. It's a 6/6. When Uro enters the battlefield, sacrifice it unless it escaped. When it enters the battlefield or attacks, you gain 3 life, draw a card, then you may put a land card from your hand onto the battlefield. It has escape. Blue-blue, green-green, exile 5 other cards from your graveyard. So... I think the escape cost of 4 is fair. I think 4 mana to get a 6/6 that gets you a land, a card, and 3 life is really good.
Yeah.
You have to have 5 to do it, but I love the cost of this card. I think this card is beautifully designed. I think it's super cool. I love that early in the game you're going to spend 3 to ramp, gain 3, and draw a card. Seems like a Risen Reef. Seems totally fair.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. It is like a Risen Reef that escapes later. What's interesting about this card to me is like, you need to be kind of a blue-green spell-based deck so you can reliably escape. And then this is like the win con for your spell-based deck. Because when it enters the battlefield or attacks, you get all this value. So this is like a win con for a deck that can reliably put 5 cards in the graveyard. And then you just keep putting cards in the graveyard and just escape this a bunch of times. Like if they kill it, you just escape again. And then, you know, you just have this resilient threat that keeps coming back and generating value. And hopefully it eventually kills them. Because you don't want to play this in a creature deck, because it's tougher for you to get 5 other cards in your graveyard if you're like playing permanents.
Yeah, I would agree. I think I like the idea of this being in sort of a blue-green, like a blue-green tap-out spell-based tempo deck, maybe. I could experiment with this one of those like boomerang-style decks that I'm always so fond of, where I just keep bouncing your land on turn 2 and then on turn 3. But I definitely think this is one of the cooler cards. I also like the creature type a lot. Elder Giant is sick.
Elder Giant is sick. Yeah, I mean, you can Collected Company into this, but again, like if you're playing Collected Company, you want a super high creature count, and it's going to be tough to get to escape mana. So then it's just like kind of a weird little draw a card, gain 3 life, maybe play an extra land attached to your Collected Company, which is not as appealing as like, you know, being able to escape it multiple times.
Yeah, I mean, this feels like, and so this card feels to me like what I imagine how this is going to play in Standard it's going to fit right into the same shell of these bigger mana blue-green decks that we've already been seeing in Standard.
Yeah.
The Risen Reef decks that play Krasis that, you know, like...
Yeah, or like the Nissa decks.
They're playing the Cavalier and everything. Yeah. Like, they want to resolve big things.
This feels and like the Cavalier puts the five cards in your graveyard, so that's why people are really excited about Cavalier.
Yeah. You know, I have to say, and we talked about this, I think, one of the last episodes, but it never fails to amaze me how the cycles of mythics in core sets, going back to the Titans, and then obviously, I guess they're not always in core sets, but, you know, the Titans, the Gear Hulks, the Cavaliers, I'm forgetting another one of these cycles.
There's a bunch of them.
It never fails to amaze me how in Standard, even if I think they're not that good, they always see so much play. They always do.
Like, well, Wizards designed them to be played.
The Cavaliers?
Yeah.
Or just in general?
I think whenever they design a set, like a cycle of mythic creatures like that, they're meant to get played.
Yeah. They have to be powerful enough for people to want to play them.
Yeah. I think like those kind of become marquee cards that people latch onto. Like this is, you know, one of the big blue mythics. I want to be able to play it. Like obviously Planeswalker is usually first on people's list. Maybe legendary creatures after that.
Yeah.
And then beyond that, people are looking at like big splashy creature cycles, and I think that they make sure that when you look at those three things, you're looking at, you know, the marquee legendaries of the set that are on the packs and stuff, you're looking at the planeswalkers, and you're looking at like the big cool mythic cycles. They don't disappoint.
Absolutely.
And I think the gods, like for Standard, do that, but you know, not so much for the formats we like to talk about.
Yeah. All right, guys, I think that's going to wrap up part one of our set review here. We talked about some of the ones we're most excited about. We'll do some more on the next episode. Try to maybe we'll wait one more week and sort of do the second part of it after the full spoiler hits so we can make sure we cover the second half. But we will definitely get to the rest of the cards in Theros Beyond Death once Alex Kessler is back. Thank you guys so much for watching. Thanks for listening. Thanks to Ruben for sticking around, for engineering and producing the show today. Michael, thank you for showing up and being knowledgeable and handsome.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for being handsome.
I appreciate that, Michael. Thank you. And thank you all for supporting the show and for watching. Go to patreon.com/themmcast if you guys want to support what we're doing. Click that subscribe button if you want to support the YouTube. And if you got 7 YouTube notifications about us going live earlier today, we apologize. Thank you guys so much. We'll see you same time at same place next week. Bye, everybody.
This has been a production of Time Traveler Media. Sending podcasts into the future.